Chapter 17. Danae had stayed in the kitchen, puttering with herbs. She knew that some of them had healing properties, but not which and in what proportions. Some of Edmund's books had marginal notes on them, though, so she had gotten the few available and had been grinding sorrel when Shida appeared. "Danae," Shida said from the doorway. The mortar and pestle flew across the room, the pestle cracking in two against the hard stone wall, as Danae practically jumped out of her skin. "Don't do that!" "I'm sorry," the Avatar replied. "I didn't think." "Well, sorry doesn't cut it, sis," Danae replied bitterly. "Well, I am," Shida said. "If I'd suspected it would come apart so fast, I would have done more." "Thanks for nothing, sister," Danae snarled. "All you would have had to do was set a damned Avatar looking for me. Was that too much to ask?" The Avatar sighed and shook her head. "In retrospect, no. But at the time I was rather busy, and, as I said, I didn't expect lawlessness to break out so fast. Humans are so..." "Sick," Danae said. "We're beasts inside, sis. That's something you never realized, or at least never internalized. I don't know what I did until I met Mechanic." "Well, I'm getting a lesson in it worldwide," Shida replied. "There are 4,320 reported rapes just in the towns that are reporting to me. And in the ones that aren't, the conditions in some of them are..." "I don't know some days, Danae. Sometimes I think we should just give in to Paul, given what the world is like today. Being a woman in this world is..." "What women survived for millennia," Danae replied. "And don't come crying to me about your problems. I guarantee that you don't wake up nights in a cold sweat seeing Mechanic's face in front of you. Or worse." Shida paused for a moment, then shrugged. "Danae, I can... how to put it? This can go away for you. No more nightmares." Danae thought about it for a moment, then shook her head. "Can you do it for all of them?" "In time, perhaps," Shida said after a moment. "It doesn't take much more power than simply talking like this." "No," Danae said after a moment. "No, that's not the answer. I'm fine, really, except for the nightmares. And they'll go away. They have to." She trailed off. "You need to talk about it," Shida said. "I've accessed some very old texts. Rape is as forgotten as..." "Everything else," Danae nodded. "Rape and economic and sexual domination. We were shielded from it for so long. Machines freed women and computers empowered them. But it's all back, and in a way it's all of a piece. Take away the technology and women are nothing but pawns to the males. We have to find a way to deal with it now and in this world, not patchwork in the old world. Then find someone to talk to. That's what everyone keeps saying, except the women who went through it. And we don't want to talk about it, thank you. Especially to family, sis. That's what the texts said you'd say. But they also are definite. You need to talk about it. To get out the bad thoughts and find out what is real in you and what is an effect of the rape. I don't suppose you can get some of these texts to me," Danae said sourly. "Not yet. Soon, maybe," Shida said. "Sending an avatar is one thing. Teleporting texts, or even items that can receive updates, is another. We're on the thin edge of losing right now. If we can just get some breathing room, maybe then." "Well, until then, thank you, but no thank you. I'll just put up with the nightmares, and get back on the horse." "Be careful with that," Shida said. "You'll probably have some ugly flashbacks, and other things." Shida paused and shook her head. "You're right. There's things I don't want to talk to you about. Just be careful. Everything that happens may not be natural."
"Damn it, in that whole camp of historical idiots, there has to be someone that has studied rape. It was a natural feature of all that wonderful history they loved so much. The only ones that might have are Edmund and maybe a guy named Gunny," Danae said. "And I don't care to talk to either of them about it, thank you very much."
"You're being very stubborn about this, sister dear," Shida said.
"I'm a Gorbani," Danae said with a faint smile.
Shida started to say something, then looked startled.
"I have to go. Talk to someone, damn it."
"Goodbye, Shida," Danae said.
"Bye."
Danae took a deep breath after Shida left and thought about the roster of people in Raven's Mill.
"Damn, she's right," she muttered, then walked to a cupboard and took out a bottle of brandy.
She looked at the cups and then shook her head and took a deep pull from the bottle. I can't believe that I'm going to do this. She looked at the door and then pulled a cloak down against the evening chill and went walking out the door. She had an idea who to talk to. Now to find her. McGibbon had just drawn a bead on the lead doe of the herd when he froze at a flash of white out of the corner of his eye. He couldn't figure out what the patch was until it moved again, and then he identified it. It was that damn cat of Rachel's. He'd been stalking the herd of deer for the last half hour. Stalking was a highly skilled art, but he'd been practicing for nearly 50 years, and it was second nature to him at this point. The first part was finding the quarry, which was a matter of moving through the woods as if he was a deer himself. That required moving a few steps, then pausing, and actually making a bit of noise. If you tried to move absolutely silently, it was impossible. So you had to move as if you were a foraging animal. A few steps, a movement of a foot, watch, listen, smell, then move on. The most important thing was to sight the deer before they spotted you. If you did that, you could close in on them with relative ease. Foraging whitetails couldn't spot movement when their heads were down, and they flipped their tails before they raised their head, so you kept an awareness of their movement, an alpha state in which whenever they started to flick, you froze instantly and, at least at his level, almost unconsciously. They would raise their heads, look around, and then go back to eating, which let you get closer. He had gotten to within a stone's throw of the deer and had just drawn his bow when he spotted the cat. On the other hand, it was doing much the same thing. He watched it as it froze in its stalk, just as the deer lifted their heads again. There were about 15 deer in the herd, foraging on fallen acorns at the edge of a natural meadow. He was on the west edge of the meadow, and the cat had apparently entered on the southeast edge. Now it was doing a careful and quiet stalk. And despite the fact that the town needed the food, he let the bowstring slip silently forward to watch. As soon as the deer's heads went back down, the cat moved forward again, its belly to the ground half hidden in the tall grass at the meadow center. It moved cautiously, lifting each paw and placing it so that Robert suspected it was making less noise than he would. Slowly it worked its way to the edge of the tall grass and appeared to focus on one deer on the edge of the herd. The button buck was probably from the last year's births and just about ready to be driven out of the herd. As a sign of its relative status, it had been driven to the edge of the herd, where the acorns were the fewest, and it was assiduously searching for anything edible it could find. This meant it had its head down far more than the rest of the herd and far more than was wise, and if the cat wasn't overreaching, the buck might not live to learn the lesson. Robert watched the stalk until the cat paused at the edge of the grass, then drew his bow again. It was the only compound bow in the village, and while it was a very strong draw, the nature of the compound's bow dropped the hold weight, the amount of pull necessary to keep drawn to its full length, to barely half its maximum 150 pounds. But even 75 pounds can be a lot to hold for very long, and he hoped the cat would make its move soon. It did. As the buck moved just a tad further out, searching for the elusive wind-blown acorns. When the deer got to within a bare 5 meters of the cat, the white and orange tom burst out of the grass in a dead sprint and leapt onto the deer's back. Robert hadn't bothered to watch the charge. At the first flicker of movement, he had loosed the arrow straight into the sweet spot behind the doe's shoulder. However, despite having a broadhead arrow through her heart, the doe bounded away with the rest of the herd, intent on leaving the commotion of the attack of the cat behind her. Robert now watched in bemusement as the cat first shifted its grip to the deer's throat, dragging it around and down by sheer weight. Then, as soon as the buck was on the ground, the cat made a lightning change to a clamp on its muzzle. Deprived of oxygen, the deer thrashed and twisted, but to no avail. The house lion had the big buck down, and down it was going to stay. With a final kick and thrash, the deer lay still. "Bravo!" McGibbon said, clapping lightly in applause. "Very nice, but you made my doe run off. Now I'm going to have to track her down." Azure looked up in startlement as if he hadn't noticed the human until then, and let out a mew. He stalked over through the grass, his tail high and butted into Robert's hand, getting blood from his muzzle all over the archer's glove. "You're some cat," the hunter chuckled, rubbing him behind the ears. "I'm more of a dog person, but I could take a shine to you." When Danae pushed open the door to the pub, she was hit by a blast of sound. A red-headed female minstrel was leading a Celtic band in a rollicking jig. Danae glanced around the crowd and didn't see who she was looking for, so she started to back out when Estrelle appeared at the edge and nodded at her. "Mistress Talbot, it has been a long time," the homunculus said. She had her usual skimpy tavern wench outfit on, and a tray held up in either hand, but she nodded in greeting. "Hello, Estrelle," Danae said, and asked if she'd seen her quarry. "Right down by the foot of the stage," Estrelle said. "She comes in here every night to dance." Danae wormed her way uneasily around the edge of the crowd and stopped about halfway. The heat and the noise and the smell was starting to get to her, but having come this far, she was damn sure going to keep on going. Finally, she got up near the stage and saw her. Bast had shed her bow and sword, and now was a spinning dervish in front of the stage. There were several people in a line on either side trying to keep up with the jig, but even if it had started slow, the tempo had sped up to the point that no normal dancer could possibly keep up. Bast, however, was no normal dancer. She was perfectly on beat and adding additional moves, including spins, kicks, and even the odd backflip, each of them perfectly in time to the music. The jig had reached the end of the cycle, and the red-headed fiddler tried to pick up the tempo again, but the band began falling apart. It was simply too fast for most of them to play. Bast, however, stayed right with them until the minstrel finally gave up with a screech of her bow and nodded in defeat to the elf. People, mostly men, were crowded around the elf, but she seemed to be able to fend them off with some sort of karma personal protection field. Even the drunkest was giving her space. She nodded to the band, walked over to pick up her weapons, and wormed her way through the crowd to where Danae was standing. "Methinks you didn't come down here for a drink," Bast said, looking at her calmly. "No, I didn't," Danae replied with a gulp. "And this is no place to talk," Bast said. "I suggest Edmund's house." "Okay," Danae said, following her out. As with the dancers around the stage, when she moved through the crowd it seemed to part as if by magic, and Danae kept close on her heels all the way to the door. "What I wanted to talk about," Danae said when they got outside and she could talk without shouting. "How much liquid courage did you take on board to go find me?" Bast asked. "I had a drink of brandy."
"Just one?"
the elf said, amusement in her voice.
"Not nearly enough. Wait until we get to the house. But do not fret on the way. Yes, I know what you need to talk about, and yes, I know some of what you need to know. And no, it will not be easy, on either of us, but it will be well. I tell you this as Bast, and Bast is never wrong."
Strangely comforted by that, Danae followed her back to the house. In silence, the elf rummaged in the drink cupboard and pulled out a bottle of wine, then made a fire and settled the two chairs in front of the fire. She pulled out goblets and filled them both to brimming. "Drink," she said, pointing at the goblet. Danae picked it up and took a sip.
"No, drink,"
Bast said, taking her own and tipping it up to drain it. Danae swallowed and then lifted the goblet to down it. The wine was not brandy, but it was fortified, winter wine with a higher-than-normal alcohol content. The total of the goblet was probably more alcohol than in the shot of brandy she had had before going to the pub. She suddenly remembered that she had skipped dinner. Bast filled both the cups again, then nodded.
"You were raped by Dionys Mechanic," Bast said.
"And others."
"How many?"
"There were 7 others," Danae said, shuddering.
"I don't think..."
"You will talk about it," Bast said. "You must. You can talk about it. You relive it every night. Don't just talk to yourself, talk to me. Bast knows. Bast knows the evil that comes in the night. In dreams and without. Oh yes, Bast knows.
You?"
"It takes much to rape an elf," Bast said obliquely. "I know the evil in humans and elf. I am old, Danae. I have seen the evils of the AI wars. I know."
"8 of them, then.
They held you?" Body Danae took a deep breath and started talking, haltingly at first, but as Bast drew her out with careful questions, it all spilled out, and as it did, she relived it, every awful moment, as if it was happening all over again. By the time she was crying, she realized that she'd drunk most of the bottle of wine and wondered how that had happened.
"So, and," Bast said when she was finished,
"there is more to it, though. What did Herzer have to do with it?" Danae hesitated and looked at the elf, her head cocked on the side. "You and Herzer are friends," Bass said with a smile. "He too bears scars. I have not invested the time in him that I have in you, but I have invested enough. I want to know what his scars are, from you." "He was with Dionys when they caught me," Danae said. "There were too many of them, and Dionys was armed with a sword. There was no way he could keep me from being raped, so he ran. He tried to knock them off me on the way. At least I think he did, but he didn't succeed. And then he came back, after." "Thus and so," Bast sighed. "What fun we are all having. Have you tried to get back on the horse?" "No," Danae said in a small voice. "Not long enough, methinks," Bast replied with a nod. "Tell me about the dreams." "That's hard. Harder than the rape itself, methinks," Bast said with an unhappy grin. "Let me tell you a few things, then. You relived the rape, yes?" "Yes," Danae said tightly. "And sometimes the reason you wake up in terror is that you orgasm."
"Bast!"
"True?" the elf said hardly. "True." Danae lowered her face into her hands and nodded. "Yes."
"Normal," Bass said, "definitely. You think that you are evil or sick or twisted beyond repair, yes? This is normal. For humans, anyway."
"That's sick," Danae said, crying. "Hey, one of the reasons we elves know you humans are the result of evolution is how screwed up you are mentally. A well-designed species isn't so flighty."
"So elves don't have these problems with rape?"
Danae asked, interested in spite of herself.
"Very hard to rape an elf," Bast repeated. "Harder to survive. Few things that can break an elf out of dream. Few things that can make them hate. Elves are too happy to hate. But when we hate well. Elf that is raped dreams. Oh, yes. But they dream of new and more awful things to do to their rapist. Dream their death over and over again. Elves hate very well. One of the things we're designed to do is hate. But mostly we're too happy. Be glad. Elves not so happy. Humans no longer be here. You need to get back on the horse, but not yet. And know something when you do. It won't be good. No matter how loving Edmund is, you're going to be back there again. Worse, you might enjoy it. There is such a thing as bad sex, and that's it."
"Yes," Danae said.
"But it will get better," Bass said with a shrug. "Each time it will be a little easier. Other problem, how do you feel about men now?"
"I'm not sure," Danae said. "Some of them I'm okay with. Others make me want to scream."
"Don't get to hating them all," Bass said. "It is an easy trap to run away from them and wish they were all dead. Even elves don't hate that way. Each man is different. The ones that make you want to scream, you're probably feeling something from them. Trust that instinct, but don't hate them all. That, too, is damage, and you have to work on. Last big question. Were you a submissive before you were raped?" Danae opened her mouth to voice her favorite protest and clapped it shut. It was a valid question. "Not openly. Did you play the games?"
"No," she admitted. "I never could. I couldn't bring it up."
"Not even with Edmund?" Bass said, surprised. "He's not fetished that way, but he plays the game very well."
"Not even with Edmund," Danae admitted.
"Humph. Bet he knew.
Fantasies?"
"Yes," she said quietly.
"Rape?"
Danae paused, then sighed.
"Yes."
"Okay, Dr. Bass recommend not play that game for a while."
Danae couldn't help it. She started giggling, which turned into a full-bore laugh, which somehow segued back into tears until she was sobbing so hard she couldn't catch her breath. She realized she was in Bast's lap and being held by strong arms.
"Cry, little human, cry," Bast whispered. "Cry until you're cried out. Tears are the only thing that shows that humans might have had a creator. Too weak, too fragile, scared of the whole world. But if there was a creator, she gave them tears to face it and go on."
Danae finally caught her breath and looked at the elf holding her.
"Thank you," she said, and then, for some reason, kissed her full on the lips.
"You're welcome," Bass said after the kiss was over. "But not tonight. I've got a headache."
Danae broke out in giggles again and shook her head.
"Me too. All that wine, I think."
"Yes, and it's time for you to go to bed," Bass said, lifting the larger woman effortlessly off her lap.
"Alone."
"Alone," Danae agreed, and was surprised and worried that she wasn't sure she wanted to be alone. She'd never had a sexual thought about another woman before.
Bast, I don't want you to think that, she paused, is okay. I'd put it down to another effect of the rape, Bast said, supporting her to bed. She got her undressed and tucked in and then kissed her on the forehead. Lots of things messed up in you from it, but you'll get better. Trust Bass. Sleep. Deep sleep. No dreams. No dreams, Danae said muzzily, wondering why she was so tired. Sleep, little human, Bass said, placing her head on her forehead. Sleep well. As Danae faded into sleep, the last thing she remembered was Bast curling up on the floor as if she intended to stay for a while. And if her sleep was troubled by dreams, they were fled at the sight of a sword-wielding being in white. Shida nodded tiredly at the avatar of Ishtar and then sighed at her face. "What is it now?" she asked, unwrapping her jewel-covered lizard from her neck and cradling it in her arms. "I have determined the source of the power that Paul's faction is drawing upon," Ishtar said without preamble. "It is a power draw from core storage." "But," Shida paused, "but the only ones who can do a core draw are the elves. That is how the lady is closing Elfheim." "That is not the only source for core draws," Ishtar said bitterly. "They are using power from the terraforming projects." "Oh," Shida said after a moment's thought, "how truly good." "What I have been unable to determine is why they can draw upon it," Ishtar went on. "They have to have a quorum of the board of directors of one or more of the projects agreeing to release the power. And I can't imagine that happening." "I can," Shida said after long thought. "But oh, but that is a deep-laid plan," she muttered. "What plan?" Ishtar asked, her brows furrowing. "Edmund, he told me to look at the demon at the center of this," Shida said with a grimace. "And I think he must be right. I was asked to look into some things before this war erupted. There had been some disturbing things going on with the Wolf 359 terraforming project. One of the people who had risen to prominence was well known to me. Not a good person, and not the sort of person to care about something that wasn't going to do him any good?" Ishtar asked. "Something like that. But it didn't come together. Now it does, and we are truly in trouble." "But the rest of the board members?" Ishtar asked. "They have to be present to vote. In the event of large-scale disruption, there is probably a protocol for rump voting," Shida said, dropping into the net to open up the data. "Yes, there is," she said distantly. "And while we cannot access the board members' location or status, Mother assuredly could. If they had assassins waiting for the majority of the board, then their handpicked members would be the only ones left," Ishtar hissed. "Evil, yes, and much too Byzantine for Paul," Shida added, rising back up out of the data flow. "This has the demon's fingerprints all over it." "What do we do about it?" Ishtar asked. "Find the members of the board," Shida said, "and either get them to vote to store the power or at least stop them from giving it to Paul." "And how do we do that?" Ishtar asked, throwing her hands in the air. "We don't know where anyone is." "We'll send out a list to all the communities that report to us," Shida replied, pulling up the list. "These are all the members who were alive before the fall," she added, looking over the list. "Know any of them?" "No," Ishtar said, then looked at her fellow councilmember's face. Shida stopped looking at the list with a frozen and angry expression on her face. "What?" "I do," Shida hissed.